Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang kunutrang upacayang namasami. One of the great joys of giving a Dhamma talk in Amaravati is the big Dhamma seat. In Thailand, some of the Dhamma seats are so small, you know, you have to climb up on them, and it's such a... It's a very pleasant Dhamma seat, thank you. This morning, the senior monks were paying respects to Lumbu Sumedho, and many of them were wishing Lumbu Sumedho a long life of 120 years. Even 150 years, that was the highest bid, 150 years. And so I was thinking maybe we would be looking back on today with some nostalgia when Lumpur's age was simply double digit. May that be so. So it's a great honor to be here and to be able to express my own great respect and love for Lumbu Sumedho. I first met him in London, in Hampstead Vihara, in 1978. And I spent the rains retreat as an Anagarika with him, and there was Tawira Dhammo, Bosujito, Ajahn Wajiro, and they were all there at that time. And I've never spent the rains retreat with Lumbu Sumedho because I made a vow when I was first in Thailand that I would spend every rains retreat of my life in Thailand, and so it's never worked out for me in that way. But, of course, I felt blessed by my relationship with him and to be able to look up to him as such a great example. And when we think about, we remember them, their words, their actions, their manner, their gestures. This is sankhanusati. This is something that uplifts our mind. I remember seeing, you know, I'm sure you've seen some of those photographs of Lumpo when he was a sailor and when he was young. And for me, I never quite believed those pictures, because for me, Lumpo Sumedho is like a monk 100%, and I still can't picture him as a layman. I know the photographs are there and they're not fakes, I don't think, but for me, he's monk through and through. And his whole life has been so focused on Dhamma and Vinaya that he's been such a great example to all of us. Few teachers, even few great teachers, are able to train students and train disciples who are able to flourish in the holy life and to be great teachers in their own right. And this is one of the inspiring features of Lumpo Sumedho's monastic career. You can look in the assembly here. We have monks like Lumpo Wiradamo, Lumpo Sujito, Lumpo Menindo, of course Lumpo Amaro, and Somhal Jamujiro, so many others. These are monks who were trained and inspired by Lumpo Sumedho and now training and inspiring their own students around the world, and their students will do the same. So this is a quality and a superpower of Lumpo Sumedho. He's able to train and uplift. And of course, excuse me, I forgot to mention Anjan Chantasiri and Anjan Sundara also, and the Siladharas. And Lumpo Sumedho, as everyone knows, went to Thailand in the 1960s, and he was the trailblazer. He was the first Westerner who ever went to Wat Pho Phong. Indeed, he was the first Westerner that Ajahn Chah and most of them, all of the monks probably had ever seen. And it was so much more difficult for him than any of us who came afterwards. I'm reminded of that well-known sutta in which Venerable Sariputta compares the Four Noble Truths to the elephant's footprint, and that all the footprints of all the animals in the jungle will all fit within the elephant's footprint. And in the same way, all the teachings of the Lord Buddha will fit within the Four Noble Truths. And I felt as a young monk that we were all, within the frame, within the footprint of Lumpo Sumedho. All our footprints fitted in the footprint of Lumpo Sumedho. And in the early years, when becoming a monk, for Westerners to become a monk in Thailand was not so easy, a very kind of unusual thing to do. Knowing that there was a monk in northeast Thailand who'd been a monk for years and not only survived but was really becoming in his own right a very inspiring teacher, that was a tipping point, I think, for many young Westerners. Here's someone, he's done it, he can do it, why can't I? So that he's already contributed so much to our Sangha just by putting up with all the difficulties of Wat Pho Phong and enduring and not only surviving but becoming such a great monk himself. So Lumpo Sumedho was our Kalyanamitta, is our great friend, and I think I really like to contemplate the qualities of the Kalyanamitta. And his first two or three qualities, firstly, he inspires love and affection, secondly, inspires respect, thirdly, inspires emulation. Actually, the third point is translated in a couple of different ways, so I'll get back to that one. But firstly and secondly, the Lumpo Sumedho has always inspired that kind of affection. You're somebody you just want to be around, you just want to sit there, even if he's not teaching anything in particular. It's just really so uplifting and enjoyable in a very wholesome way to be in his company. And someone who inspires that kind of affection and devotion, if that's not balanced by a personality or a practice which inspires respect, it can become a little lopsided. And the relationship between the teacher and the pupil may not evolve as it should. But when we have teachers who inspire both affection and respect, then you have this wonderful balance. And the teacher-pupil relationship becomes a truly beautiful and noble thing. So he inspires affection, respect through his personality, respect also in his own personal practice. You see how he lives his life, how impeccably he lives his life. And there's that respect. And also that gives you a confidence in the training and the practice. Because as you know, Lumpo Sumedho, following in Jinchar's footsteps, would be always been very honest about his own difficulties and struggles. And seeing someone who has overcome his weaknesses, his defilements through this practice gives you confidence in the practice. And seeing how consistent and how unshakable he is in his own practice, then that leads you to want to emulate him. This is the third point. This third point, as I said, has two possible meanings. One is he inspires the desire, the chanda to emulate, to follow in their footsteps. But the other meaning of this term, vanyo, is that you become better, you as a human being, by being close to someone like this and listening to them, not just listening, but taking what they say to heart and trying to apply it to your own life. So this is, I think, the essence of good friendship, and which is not only to be seen in human beings of the stature of Lumpu Sumedho, but generally, if you're with someone and you think, if I did not know this person, if I didn't have this relationship with this person, so many of the good qualities I have now, I don't know whether I would have these good qualities at all. And when I look in the past and the bad habits and bad qualities that I've been able to abandon, I don't know whether I could have done that by myself at all. But because of my relationship to this person, I feel that unwholesome dhammas are waning, wholesome dhammas are waxing, I am more and more firmly progressing on the path. So this is something that we receive from teachers, and all of us have received from Lumpo Sumedho. Another quality, quality of patience. So the teachers, Jinchar, the great forest teachers, follow in the tradition of the Lord Buddha himself in the Avada Patimokkha, who proclaimed Kanti Paramang Tapo Titika. So patient endurance is the supreme incinerator of defilements. And when I was first at Wapapong, I think otton was the first Thai word I heard. I remember one of the very first long Dhamma Desanas, you're sitting as, just a little bit about myself, I'd practiced sitting cross-legged for some time, a couple of years before I went to Wapapong or before I came to England, and then thinking I'd be well prepared for a monastic life. And then I met this dreaded papir posture, sitting to one side, and it's so kind of, you know, imbalanced and awkward, and I still don't like it after 45 years. But I do it anyway. But when you first start, and you're sitting on that concrete floor in Wapapong, and it's like hours, and you're absolutely not allowed to sit cross-legged, you know, that's absolutely, you'd be, feel like you'd be kicked out if you did that. You know, it's like taboo. And mosquitoes and all this, and they can't understand anything. And then just here, every now, it's like a punctured, it's like a chorus in this Dhamma talks, otton. And then it's otton, otton. So you get really fascinated. What is this word? This is obviously like a key word here. And I asked one of the Western monks who spoke Thai, all that patient endurance. I said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So as I said, you know, Lumpur Sumedho was just such a wonderful example of that. And he has many stories that I'm sure you're familiar with, and I won't repeat here. But as his life changed and he became a teacher, then there's a whole different kind of patience needed. And for a Kalyana Mitra or a teacher, the Kalyana Mitra, it's the patience of putting up with your students and disciples. That's probably more difficult than hard concrete floors and swarms of mosquitoes. And he had so many challenges. I mean, those of you who've been around, you know what he's been through with worldly dhammas of praise and blame and people thinking it's wonderful and people thinking it's terrible and accusations that were unfair. And you can really see that no matter how well you live your life, you're never going to be free of this kind of worldly dhamma. That's why they're called worldly dhammas. Whatever world you live in, you know, in the human realm, whether it's a marketplace or a monastery, you have to deal with these things. And I think he dealt really well and had some really strong challenges over the years. But right back in the very early days, I can remember a short time I spent in Hampstead Vihara, and how the people were coming off the street, and some of them were Buddhists, and some of them were curious, and some of them just come to like sort of pick an argument. And one person attacked Lumpur with this, you know, the classic kind of dilemma: oh, you're a pacifist, is that right? So what would you do if a madman came after your mother with a knife? You know, you're just going to sit there and meditate and try not to get angry or whatever. And so what I really admired so much, and it was a really good teaching to me, is that Lumpur didn't answer the question in the terms that it was posed. So that's one of the first things you learn as a teacher, because many questions, people don't really know how to pose questions, and there's a question behind the question, or maybe a question behind the question, or there's an assumption behind the question, and a false belief behind the assumption, and so it's quite a test of wisdom to when you put on the spot. And that kind of question, where, you know, any situation is one where there are so many different causes and conditions, and these kind of moral dilemma questions where you just take out one or two strands and just hit someone with it. What would you do if a crazy man was going to stab your mum with a knife? You know. So Lumpur had the mindfulness, and he was patient with this, because it was clear this man didn't have such, you know, a pure intention, I don't think. And Lumpur just said, I'm confident that I would have the mindfulness to behave in the best possible way. That's how I remember it. So not getting caught into that whole kind of moral dilemma style, but saying, you can't know beforehand all the different things that are going on, but what you can know is that if you lose your mindfulness, you won't make good decisions, and if you're mindful, you'll make good decisions. So that's where you put your faith. You don't put your faith in some plan or some theory or philosophy, but based on personal experience, you know, I make my best decisions when I'm mindful. I'll know what the right thing to do is then. So this really impressed me, how he was patient with people, all the different people, both his students and then other people who were not his students at all, and how he just bared with the ups and downs of monastic life. And And there are a lot, as with any lifestyle. It's not that you become a monk and it's a heaven realm by any means. It's a worldly realm, it's a human realm. So Lumpo had this gift of communication. You could see that he could uplift, instruct, inspire people from all different backgrounds, different countries all around the world. People listen to him, people read, people benefit, people take what he says away with them, put it to the test of their experience, and they say, yeah, that's really true. And that is the character of satta, or faith in Buddhasasana. It's not faith in dogmas, which you have, you cannot possibly prove, but you simply have a choice to believe or not to believe. In Buddhism, we're making statements, observations, hypotheses about human life, real human life here and now, and saying, does this make sense to you? So that's one kind of teaching, the observation. The second kind of teaching is saying, well, if that does make sense to you, then the question is, what is the wisest possible way of dealing with that natural truth? And the whole of the Buddha's teachings are divided into those two categories, the revelation or the posing of hypotheses, observations, about human life, and then suggestions and how would be the best way to deal with them. So we see this right up to the Buddha's last discourse, where the Buddha says all things are impermanent, subject to change. That's the observation. Therefore, you should perfect yourself in heedfulness. Said if you accept the first clause, then what implications are there for your life? Buddhism is very practical like this. And Lungpo Sumedho has his unique style of speaking. And because many of his students have adopted a similar kind of style, maybe it's not so obvious, but a quite revolutionary way of teaching. When years and years ago, there was nobody else who was speaking, just talking about personal experience. And he's not on the Tamad on the Dhamma seat like this. He's not like sermonizing or speechifying. He's not pontificating. He's saying, I'm looking at this. I don't know about you, but what I feel is like this and this. And so he's drawing you in. He's talking about human life, not as a kind of philosophical proposition, but he's grounding it in his own experience, and he's very humble about it as well. He said, maybe you're not, this is how it feels to me, is it? And he's able to come up with these short phrases that encapsulate what he's trying to say. It's like this. What is it like? That's not telling you it's like this, or it's like ABC. It's like this is, it's a question, isn't it? It's phrased as a statement, but it's actually a question, because it's like this. Well, it's like what? Maybe Ajahn Chah's equivalent to this, although he had a similar phrase in Thai, which again was really borrowed from Ajahn Buddhadasa, who was the first one who used to say Ben Chen Nan Eng. But with Lumpu Char, he would have the answer to it's like this. It's my nair, it's not sure. But it's like this is such a wonderful teaching, isn't it? Because it stops and you look at yourself, and when you're trying to see, how is it actually, then what happens? You become aware of what you're adding to the situation. And what you're adding to the situation is dhanha, usually. It's one of the kinds of craving. So you expose the craving. If it's something unpleasant, and you say it's like this, then you realize, you're not wanting it to be like this, which is actually the suffering involved. Or if it's like this, when something's really pleasant, and maybe there's a grasping, an attachment. So this is a teaching, and it's, again, analogous to the Toraman teachings of Lumpur Cha, where you frustrate desire in order to expose it. That kind of teaching demands very strong faith in the wisdom and the compassion of the teacher for you to go along with it. But with Lumpur Sumedho's, it's like this, then that's an invitation to everyone. Just, well, what's going on right now? You know, suffering can only occur when there is wrong thinking or there is craving, which we add on to the triggers that come through eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. It's a conditioned co-production. There cannot be any mental suffering purely from the actions, the behavior of other people, or the conditions around us. So when we say, he made me so angry, she disappointed me so much, and then we're using language incorrectly, because nobody can make you suffer. Someone can make your life uncomfortable, and someone can act in ways which need to be dealt with. This is not completely passive teaching, you know, just put up with it and make your mind peaceful and let go. So there are actions and remedies to be taken in the world of sila and the world of agreements and conventions and so on. But internally, we see that only when there is craving arising do these two things come together and suffering ensue. So this is where the hope, this is where we see a path before us, and we see people who've trodden that path, like our great teachers, and shown, yes, here and now, in this day and age, it works. This is not a story from 2,500 years ago. These are timeless truths. Lastly, before I run out of time, last quality of the Kalyanamitta is he never takes you on wrong paths. So when you have a teacher, you have a lot of authority, and your words have weight. And it's very difficult for people to say no to you. So this is why the teacher has to be really, really sensitive in this area and never be putting pressure on people unnecessarily. And it's why there are so many scandals with teachers when teachers are not protected by the vinaya like they are in our tradition, or where you have an idea that when you have a certain level of spiritual maturity and excellence, then you're beyond good and evil and you don't have to keep precepts anymore. Then teachers, unfortunately, very often start to behave in unethical ways, and taking advantage of students for one's own personal pleasure or profit of some kind is something which has caused all kinds of havoc in spiritual communities and Buddhist communities, at least over the last 40, 50 years, probably, you know, forever. But in our tradition, we have the vinaya as our protection and the protection of students, and also the integrity of our teachers. And you see with Lumpur Sumedho, such a famous, revered teacher, and I've never heard of any examples anybody can say that he used that, his barami, his charisma, his power, his personal spiritual excellence as a means to take advantage of anybody ever. So that's one of the qualities of the Kalyanamitta. So he inspires affection, he inspires respect, he inspires emulation. You feel that listening to him, being close to him, you become a better human being, you progress along the path to Dhamma. He's so patient with all of your faults and your questions and your doubts, and he's able to explain himself in ways that people from all different backgrounds and can understand, and he's able to take these really profound teachings and encapsulate them and present them in ways which are so immediately engaging and inspiring and uplifting. And he never takes advantage of anyone for his own personal gain. So these are some of the reasons why I think it's such a blessing that we have this great, wonderful human being as our teacher, as a founder of this monastery, and yes, our Krupa Ajahn. So yes, all our respects and love to Lumpur Sumedho.